came from the old double double speak. Yes, with both swindled hum, no one could hear the truth above the roar. And though your debating was a stinker, they bought it all hook, line, and sinker. You razzle-dazzled home, and they gave you four more.
Too many OBGYNs aren't able to practice their love with women all across this country.
I hear there's rumors on the internets.
Greetings. This is podcast number 8 of Blast the Right. I'm Jack Clark from therationalradical.com, www.therationalradical.com. Let's see what's on the menu today. First up, we'll talk about how right-wingers kill 18,900 American babies every year. Then we'll have a little contest, Barbara Bush versus Bill O'Reilly, most vile statement by a right-winger. After that, we'll see if we can find an answer to, how cold is a right-winger's heart? Hint, I have to go back to my high school physics class to answer this one. We'll then go on to read a bit of 2 listener emails. I'll tell you how you can call in and leave comments for me to play on the podcast. And finally, I'll ask for your help in connection with the music I play on this program. In this first segment, I'm going to present another installment of the 6,458 episode series, All the Ways Right-Wingers Kill People. Kill the innocent, kill the defenseless. I don't mean with their bare hands, obviously. I mean through their ideology. When their ideology takes power and controls the government, innocent people die. In this case, it's little babies. Ask a right-winger who has the best healthcare system in the world, and he or she will invariably tell you, oh, it's the United States. We're number one. Yeah, we have the best healthcare system, right? No. One of the best ways to judge the efficiency and the effectiveness of a country's healthcare system is to look at what's called the infant mortality rate. The infant mortality rate is the number of children under the age of 1 who die per 1,000 live births. So you want to have a low infant mortality rate, so that means fewer babies under the age of 1 die. The statistics I'm about to give are from the CIA, yes, the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. They publish every year their World Fact Book, and it's right on the internet. If you want to look at the document that I'm getting my numbers from, just search for CIA infant mortality rate in Google. Where's the United States compared to the rest of the world in our infant mortality rate? Not number one, as the right-winger would certainly claim. Well, if we're not number one, certainly we're, you know, 2, 3, or 4. No, we're not. What about the top 10? The United States must be in the top 10. The top 20? No. The top 30? No. The United States is number 43 in the world in infant mortality rates. That means 42 other countries in the world do a better job of safeguarding the lives of their newborns than we do. I know a lot of listeners to this podcast are well informed in this area, and they already know the countries that would be expected to be ahead of us, and that indeed are the Scandinavian countries, all the Western European countries, Japan. But that wouldn't add up to 42 that are ahead of us. Who else is ahead of us? Aruba's ahead of us. Taiwan's ahead of us. Cuba's ahead of us. The number one country, the nation that does the best job of safeguarding the health of its little babies, is Singapore. You hear right-wingers all the time slam the Canadian healthcare system, yet they're number 23. Their infant mortality rate is 4.75, a lot worse than Singapore, but, you know, it's a hell of a lot better than ours. What is ours? Our infant mortality rate is 6.5. It's three times what the number one country, Singapore's, is. That means in the United States, three times as many United States American babies die as babies in Singapore do, proportionally per population. The bottom line, what that translates to into numbers of babies dying? Columnist Nicholas Kristof recently wrote that if the United States had the same low infant mortality rate as number one Singapore, 18,900 babies in the United States would live each year instead of die. 18,900 needless deaths of poor defenseless infants. The reason so many of these dozens of other nations have a much better infant mortality rate than we do is because they have national health care, national health insurance. Every citizen of that country is guaranteed first-class medical care. We don't have that. So many American mothers do not have proper pre- and postnatal care, and neither do their does the fetus when it's in her and the baby when it's out of her. Is there any doubt that if we had a national health care system that sought out and made sure that every pregnant woman got first-class medical care before the baby was born and after, that we could also have a low infant mortality rate like Singapore? Is there any doubt that the richest nation on earth, if it put its mind to it and had a national health care system and made lowering the infant mortality rate a number one priority, is there any doubt that we could also have a low infant mortality rate like Singapore? If we were able to do that, then 18,900 babies who died last year would now be alive. 18,900 babies this year who are going to die won't die. They would live. What's standing in the way of us having such a national health care system that would save 18,900 little babies every year? The right wing, of course. They oppose anything that helps human beings. FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, wanted to have a national health care system, but given the things that he was dealing with at the time, he didn't really push it very much. Harry Truman, his successor, was passionately committed to having a national health care system and tried to get it through, but why couldn't he? The right wing! We don't need a whole history lesson here. Let's just fast forward to the 90s, the 1990s. I'm not familiar with all the details of Hillary Clinton's proposed national health care system. Maybe it was too unwieldy and too bureaucratic, I don't know. But it was shot dead on arrival by the right wing. And it wasn't like the right wing said, well, that's a bad plan, but we want to make sure everyone has health care, so here's our plan. No, no, no. They never offer anything in its place. They just said, this plan's no good, we're not going to have it, and that was that. The hell with those 18,900 little babies that are going to die unnecessarily. We don't care about them. We just don't want national health care insurance. Because of right-wingers, the United States is the only Western industrialized country without a national health care system. And under George W. Bush, every year, the number of Americans without health insurance goes up, as does the poverty rate. No wonder our infant mortality statistics are so terrible. In fact, under Bush and the right-wing killing machine that controls Congress, our infant mortality rate actually went up last year for the first time in almost 50 years. We're going backwards under Bush. So there you have it. One of the thousands of ways right-wingers kill the innocent, kill the defenseless. The next time you're talking to some right-wingers, ask them, why are you in favor of 18,900 U.S. babies dying needlessly every year? And then, when they whine, what the heck are you talking about? Well, you just go right ahead and tell them. Okay, let's go on to the contest. this contest is going to be to find the ugliest statement by a right winger. I don't mean just a little bit ugly. I mean morally reprehensible, repugnant, vile, enough to get you nauseous. One of the rules is the statement has to be something that I have a clip of. The reason is you have to hear it. A lot of things you can read and they kind of sound disgusting, but it's only when you hear the literal evil oozing out of the lips of these people in the tone of voice and just in the ugliness that's inherent in them that you could really understand which of the statements is the most disgusting. The time period will be since the podcast started, which is about a month ago. I think clearly in that time period, the winner, without a doubt, is Barbara Bush's comment about the people she was watching in the Houston Astrodome who had been evacuated from New Orleans. I played this clip on a previous podcast. Here it is.
And so many of the people in the arenas here, you know, were underprivileged anyway. This is working very well for them.
Oh, they were poor anyway, so they're really doing very well here.
Never mind that they've been traumatized, that they've lost all their worldly possessions. Many of them are missing family members. Many of them know family members have been killed. These people face a bleak future. They're the wretched of the earth. But Barbara thinks that they're doing quite well. A statement that would be in contention, perhaps, is one that I noted in a column by Maureen Dowd. She wrote that the Wall Street Journal reported that Representative Richard Baker of Baton Rouge was overheard telling lobbyists, "We finally cleaned up public housing in New Orleans. We couldn't do it, but God did." That's pretty damn ugly, but I don't have a clip of it, so we're not going to count that, or it's not in contention. But what is in contention is something Bill O'Reilly said. Good old Bill, he can always be counted on saying something that's just the lowest in morality that you can imagine.
Every American kid should be required to watch videotape of the poor in New Orleans and see how they suffered because they couldn't get out of town. And then every teacher should tell the students, if you refuse to learn, if you refuse to work hard, if you become addicted, if you live a gangsta life, you will be poor and powerless just like many of those in New Orleans.
Wow, that almost defies analysis. Where to begin? I'll just mention two of the elements of it that are, to me, the most disturbing. One is O'Reilly invoking, as right-wingers always do, the blame the victim strategy. The people on the rooftops in New Orleans, they refused to learn. They refused to work hard. They were addicted. They lived a gangster life, and that's why they were stuck on a roof screaming for food and water in New Orleans. In other words, they deserved it. The victim deserved what happened to them. Of course, many of these people did go to school, many of these people do work hard, and they're still in poverty because, among other things, the minimum wage is so low. We discussed that the last podcast. In any case, beyond the blame the victim, O'Reilly is also invoking the social Darwinism that he loves so much. The government isn't going to help these people. It's not the role of government to figure out why so many of these people who do work hard are still poor. No, it's not the role of the government to have an adequate response to an emergency. No. That's not what's wrong with the picture of these people on the rooftops. What's wrong with it is that these people led a gangster life. There you have it, Barbara Bush versus Bill O'Reilly. Now, I was thinking, how could people vote on this? On a website, I just stick up a poll. This is a podcast, and most people don't go to the podcast homepage. I guess what I'd say is if you want to vote, which one is worse, and tell me why also, send me an email. Also, at the end of this podcast, I'll tell you how you can phone in and leave me a message on my computer, and I can count those votes too. Our discussion today about some of the ways in which right-wingers kill innocent people in fact, the unusually calm and cool and collected, unfeeling way that they go about killing innocent people leads naturally to my next subject, which is, how cold is a right-winger's heart? Now, back in podcast number 2, I laid out a case that right-wingers seem to display the psychopathological characteristics of serial killers. And I still think that, and you might want to go back and check out that podcast number 2. It's a good one. Here, however, we're going to get a little bit more poetic and just discuss, how cold is a right-winger's heart? I thought of this question in another podcast when I was talking about Barbara Bush's comment that the people in the Superdome were poor already, so they're really doing quite well after the hurricane. Now, at that point, I used the term she has a cold heart, that right-wingers have a cold heart. But I knew at that instant that the word cold didn't do it justice. We need something a lot stronger than that. So, I began thinking, what are some other terms I could have used? I thought, a frigid heart, an ice-cold heart, right-wingers have hearts like a block of ice. Those were better, still nowhere near where we need to go. Then I thought, those really talk about 32 degrees Fahrenheit, the temperature that water freezes, that's what ice is, but that is nowhere near cold enough. So I looked up, how cold does it get in Antarctica? Maybe we could say they have Antarctic hearts. Well, the average winter temperature in Antarctica is about minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's sort of getting in the right direction, but not cold enough. And then I figured, well, what's the coldest it's ever been on the face of the planet? And that's about minus 129 degrees in Antarctica at one evening many years ago. 129 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. That's getting there. I think we can do better, though, because a right-winger's heart's a lot colder than that. My solution came when I remembered back into my high school physics class, where we learned about the concept of the Kelvin, K-E-L-V-I-N, temperature scale. Now, I have to admit, besides the Kelvin temperature scale, when I thought back to my high school physics class, I also remembered something else, which, in a personal side, was that ever since the fifth grade, I had had a crush on this girl, and in my high school physics class, lo and behold, they assigned her to me as a lab partner. Well, I have to admit it that even to this very day, I'm still kicking myself in my own butt a little bit because I didn't take advantage of the opportunity then to, you know, maybe get to know her, ask her out or something. But then high school boys are not really, you know, known for their courage in those type of romantic endeavors, so I guess I can be a little easier myself. Enough of that. Let's go back to the right-wingers and how cold their hearts are. All right, so what is Kelvin? Kelvin is a temperature scale that goes way below Fahrenheit and way below centigrade. In fact, it gets to what's called absolute zero. 0 degrees Kelvin is what's called absolute zero. That's the temperature where molecules stop moving completely. It's the lowest possible temperature of anything in the universe. How cold is it? It's minus 459.4 degrees Fahrenheit is the equivalent of 0 degrees Kelvin. Okay, if it's the lowest possible temperature of anything in the universe, and all molecular motion ceases, and it's minus 459.4 degrees Fahrenheit, well then, okay, that gets the prize. That's how cold a right-winger's heart is. Now, I wish 0 degrees Kelvin had a more mellifluous sound to it, you know, because then you could kind of work it into a song or something. When I was thinking about this segment earlier, I thought, you know, this could be maybe some kind of a country western song since right-wingers like country and western music so much. I'm not a big country and western fan, but, you know, there's some good stuff there. How would it go? Well, maybe the guy could be singing, you know, like,
"Twang, you left me, baby, you got a 0 degree Kelvin heart."
Okay, sorry, I won't ever do that again. So we have something we can work with here. You can tell a right-winger, you know, you've got a 0 degree Kelvin heart. Now, they won't know what the hell you're talking about, probably. So just tell them to look it up. Tell them to Google it. Spell it for them. K-E-L-V-I-N. Tell them to Google it. You'll be teaching them something and letting them know, once they read the definition, what you really think of their level of compassion and concern for their fellow brother and sister human beings. Next, I'd like to read a bit of an email that a listener sent in to me. He criticized me for bashing Alan Combs and went on to say, "What you do on your podcast, although neat, doesn't involve any live, real-time debating with right-wingers. You have as long as you need to formulate a response to things that people have said. Alan Combs is in a studio with Hannity and plenty of other Republicans, and he stands up pretty well for someone in that situation. I just don't think you should be allowed to get off bashing him when you don't have any live debates. Furthermore, I think live debates, uncut, unedited, would be a nice feature to add to your show. I'm trying to size you up and analyze you from what I hear from your podcast. So far, I've determined that you've got potential, but you need to prove it." And I wrote back to him that I kind of agree. A live debate would be a good feature to add to the show. I don't think Alan Combs does well even in a live debate situation, but that's neither here nor there. I do intend to add live debates to this podcast. As soon as I figure out how to get a telephone call into the podcast, I'll do it. Here's another email you might get a kick out of. Like any progressive, I get a fair amount of hate mail. Most of it's just a bunch of name-calling and typical right-wing tactics. I did get one recently that stood out even among right-wingers for the utter stupidity of it. As you may know, on my site I have a little logo that says, "Listen to this podcast," or another one says, "Read this blog for a month, and you'll be able to kick the butt of any right-winger, I guarantee it." That's what it says. Now listen to what this guy wrote to me. "I would like to see you kick my ass, you spineless liberal. All talk and no action, you gay-loving, God-hating, excrement." That's not what he said, but I'll use that word. "Vervain moron. Hope to hear from you. And if you like, we can settle your comment that if we read a certain disgusting site, you can kick any conservative's ass. Let's see you cowards." If I had a martial arts website, and I was teaching people how to street fight or box or do karate, I could then see someone writing in and saying, "Oh, really? You can kick anyone's ass just from learning your techniques? Well, let's see you kick my ass. Let's meet and settle this." The challenge would be physical to physical, somewhat rational. What's amazing to me is this guy looked at the website and thinks I'm talking about a physical fight. Did I have to spell out kick any right-winger's ass in a debate? I really think this guy just thought I was talking about physically beating someone up. It's just scary, their lack of gray matter, is all I could say. I want to tell you now about a new feature I've added to the podcast. You can now call in and leave me a message, and I can play it during the podcast. There's two ways you can do this. First, if you use Skype, skype.com, on your computer with a headset, you can call my name and leave the message on the voicemail there. My Skype name is Jack from Blast the Right. That's all one word, as all Skype names are, Jack from Blast the Right. The second way is you can call me from a regular phone and leave a message, and it will be recorded by Skype, and I can retrieve it from my computer and also play it during the podcast. The number you would call for that is area code 310-933-5891. 310-933-5891. Skype says that its software that is performing these voicemail functions is only in beta now. So it may be wise for you, if you want to call me, or rather after you call me, email me and also tell me you left a message so I can make sure I got it. Not necessary to do that, though. I'm pretty sure they'll come through okay. Also, please note, a very proper-sounding woman with an English accent will announce my voicemail and ask you to leave a message. Skype is a British company, and I haven't found a way so I can change the voicemail greeting. What kind of comments can you leave? Anything you want. You can say you like the podcast. You could say you hate the podcast. You can make suggestions. You can give your own rant about a subject that I've discussed, or any other subject for that matter. The only thing I ask is, don't curse. If you curse, I won't use it, because I do not want to have to label this podcast X-rated. I'm looking forward to getting your messages, and hopefully we'll have some really interesting things to play next time. One other thing I wanted to tell you about. I'm doing this podcast all alone, and I could actually use some of your help if you're willing. One thing I want to do is get more different music clips to play during the show, at the beginning, at the end, and in between segments. If any of you have 5, 10, 15 minutes, a half an hour, and you want to go to this site I'll tell you about, and you can, you know, check out some of the music there, and send me an email with the link to the songs that you think might be good to use as bumper music, that would be terrific. The website is music.podshow.com. Music.podshow.com. There's no www there, just music.podshow.com. Well, that'll about wrap it up for today. The music that I played at the beginning, and that I'll play a little bit more at the end after I sign off, is called You Razzle Dazzled 'Em. It's by Bill Jacobs, billjacobs.us. As always, if you like what you heard on this podcast, please tell your friends about it. So until next time, I'll sign off and say I love you all, including all you right-wing pieces of crap.
I'm the old Bible Belt Bailey who you bamboozled on. Forget your AWOL and your DUI. You gave them a show that always pleases. Your friends claimed you were endorsed by Jesus. You razzle dazzle dumb, razzle dazzle dumb, razzle dazzle dumb, and made sane people cry.